Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Jim Lavoulis. David Gessner is the author of the New York Times bestselling book All the Wild That Remains. His latest work, Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness, considers the environmental work of America's 26th president. David Gessner, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thanks, Jim. Happy to be here.
Well, first off, President Theodore Roosevelt's love of nature and wild lands is well documented in his own writings and those of historians and biographers. For this book, you went to some of the very places Roosevelt visited and then protected. Why did you take that approach?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think for me as a writer, place has always been very important. In particular, I wrote my first books about Cape Cod in Colorado. In fact, that was how I landed down here in North Carolina, because some professors liked those books and asked me to move away from the places I loved, basically. So place meant a lot. So going to the Badlands and being in the Badlands, where Roosevelt experienced kind of his Western rebirth, was a way of getting to know Roosevelt. It also was an idea, like the idea was to trace his steps and to feel what he felt, you know, 120 years before.
And going to the biography side of things, as I mentioned, you write in the book that the riddle we have to answer, the essential mystery we have to solve, is how some rich kid from Manhattan, born with the silverest of spoons in his mouth, becomes the buffalo's savior. The answer has implications for us all, end quote. So why and how does Theodore Roosevelt, in your mind, who was born to a business family in New York City, mold himself into the protector and explorer of wild lands and animals?
Yeah, the early biography of Roosevelt is a lot like the early biography of Trump. And, you know, there's a silver spoon factor with both and growing up in New York. So how does that happen? What changes? Well, he's got a father who he calls Greatheart, who's actually the founder of the American Museum of Natural History, one of the founders, who's this kind of big, magnanimous character, a philanthropist and a big-hearted guy, as the name implies. And Roosevelt adores him, and he says he's the only man he's ever been afraid of, and his dad is his model. And then he starts to read kind of these adventure stories, and they segue into these stories about nature, and that segues into Darwin. This is a guy who, when he's a kid, he doesn't want to be president, he doesn't want to be a soldier, he wants to be a working naturalist like his hero Charles Darwin. And it's through birds and his study of birds that he starts to write, and he kind of leaves his own brain and his own background behind and gets into the natural world. He ends up writing 47 books in his lifetime, right? So he's a great writer, but his early writings are journal writing about birds. He gets two presents when he's 14, a pair of glasses that lets him see the world, and a rifle, because like Audubon, he shoots those birds he's studying often. And that will continue later in life. He's a big hunter, right? And we can criticize that, and people do, but it also gets him out into wild places. It gets him out into Dakota territory. It gets him out into what would become Idaho. And he sees these wild places, and he has this experience of being beyond the human in these wild places. And that, combined with his naturalist training, seems to transform him, or at least a part of him. I say in the book, I call him out for a prejudice, you know, against Native Americans, among others. But I say he avoids the largest prejudice so many of us has, which is anthropocentrism, the inability to see beyond man. And that's like his great feat, I think, at times, to see beyond the human. And that's from his training as a naturalist, his love of the wild. And imagine having that in the Oval Office. I mean, how would that be right now as we head toward fighting climate change and the world kind of shrinking around us? It would be, you know, exhilarating. I've been thinking a lot about it.
And you also write that Theodore Roosevelt practiced muscular environmentalism. What do you mean by that? I found that term very intriguing.
Well, to go back to his dad, he was a muscular Christian, as they called him at the time in the late 1800s, which meant he didn't believe in any, like, kind of the old skinny Jesus. He wanted a fit Jesus and a more manly Jesus. In the book, I travel around the country with my nephews, 21 and just graduated from college, and I would play tapes of Roosevelt's speeches and books on tape, and my nephew by the end was so sick of the phrase manly vigor that he never wanted to hear it again in his life. And you know, this is kind of this combination of this overly masculine, aggressive form of Christianity that his dad practiced. He kind of took that and funneled it into his environmentalism. I think it's amazing, because of those that early vision of nature, that he not just fought for land, saving over 230 million acres of public land in the end, but he created the arena in which it was fought. And he never, in his 7 years as president, he never had it not be one of his top three priorities. It mattered to him. And he was, you know, he was just naturally a fighter. I was just listening, totally unrelated to my book, but I was listening to a kind of greatest hits of Churchill's World War II tapes, you know, with the blood, toil, sweat, tears, and, you know, we will not surrender. And I was thinking, that's what we need. We need somebody like that talking about climate change and saying, you know, no one's been able to articulate it. And I feel like a Roosevelt could articulate why this is the big fight ahead and why we need to focus our energy on that. And he was always able to do that. He read a book a night. He was an intellectual, but he was able to take the language, distill it into a form that inspired regular people. And he did that with, you know, with public lands and with nature.
And your point there leads me to my next question. In your mind, are there any individuals or organizations practicing that muscular environmentalism today?
Well, you know, I think we have to, I mean, one of the things I say in the book is that he gave us a good rough draft back in, you know, the first decade of the 20th century. And we have to take from that draft, but we also have to be critical where it's right to be critical. Obviously, this has been a summer where Roosevelt's statue was is scheduled to be taken down in front of the American Museum of Natural History. But we have to remember that's balanced by the fact that that museum will rename its Hall of Biodiversity after Roosevelt. So all that to say, Roosevelt's a complicated character. And you know, when I post on Facebook about him, everybody comes in and says, oh, he was an imperialist, he was awful. And I'm like, yes, that's part of the story. But there's another part of the story. So I think we can take what's good about that early draft of saving the land and make it more inclusive, make it larger, make it more aware of the Native American land that this originally was. And that's being done at Bears Ears National Monument, the national monument that Obama declared and that Donald Trump undeclared, 85% of it. And I also have another example in the book, which is the Y2Y corridor, the Yellowstone to Yukon corridor, which a man named Harvey Locke thought of. And it's connecting the parks from Yellowstone all the way up to the Yukon and connecting wilderness corridors, including bridges with overpasses and underpasses that are vegetated, through which large carnivores migrate. It's basically linking parks, because conservation biologists say that islands are where species go to die, and parks are kind of islands. As bold as an idea as it was back then, a bolder idea now is to connect it. So in this time when we're, you know, fracking and ripping up every piece of land we can find, there are other people who are trying to connect these wild lands and let evolution continue. So it's a really exciting, as awful as the fires are, and they're breaking my heart, and they're right near where I used to live, as awful as so much that's going on there, there are people who are have this kind of hopeful vision of the future and are acting on it.
And I think part of that muscular environmentalism that you discuss in the book, and this also goes to what you just mentioned, Bears Ears National Monument in Utah, part of how Theodore Roosevelt used that muscular environmentalism was through the Antiquities Act.
Right.
Can you take us through that act and sort of how it came to be?
Sure. A lot of people think that Roosevelt created the Antiquities Act, but he did not. It was created by Congress, like acts are. And it kind of grew out of the fact that people were going into old ruins, like Anasazi ruins, and taking the antiquities, basically, the pots, the tools, and, you know, kind of plundering these sites. which was okay with people until Europeans started to do it. And that pissed Americans off. And they said, no, you can't do that. And that was the beginning. And then it took about a decade till this act was passed, which basically said protected these areas with antiquities, which is pretty much all the areas of the West, because you have all these, you know, former Anasazi villages and all these settlements there that are native. But the wording was, you know, we'll protect it, that area, and that will become a national monument. And in that original document, there's the phrase, at the discretion of the president. And I joke in the book that to use discretion with this particular president, Roosevelt, was kind of laughable. And sure enough, he took that act and right away started to aggressively save national monument after national monument, even down to the fact, something that's kind of become tradition, which is for presidents to make declarations at the very end of their term. I think it was the last day of his presidency, he declared Mount Olympus in Washington. So he very aggressively used the act and kind of set a precedent for others to have used it. For me, this book began on October 27, 2017. Bears Ears National Monument, which is unique in that it's the only national monument to grow out of the thinking, planning, and work of Native American tribes, the Navajo, the Hopi, the Ute, the Zuni, and the Ute Mountain Ute. For 5 years, they had come up with this plan for using kind of an American tool for a new purpose, a United States tool for a new purpose. In fact, one of the members of the council, Regina Lopez Whiteskunk, said to me, look, what we're trying to do here is not relive historical indignities. We're trying to do something new. And so sure enough, they did put this proposal together. And in December of 2016, Obama declared Bears Ears National Monument in southeast Utah, which is a spectacular place where I've spent a lot of time. And then 10 months later, Ryan Zinke, who was then Secretary of the Interior under Trump, standing in front of a picture of Teddy Roosevelt on the day that would have been Teddy Roosevelt's 159th birthday and declaring himself a Roosevelt Republican, undeclared that land, 85% of it. So that made me upset enough to, you know, head out on my trip and decide that this is what I wanted to write about. I mean, I had a lot of friends writing about politics, you know, what happened the day before. But to me, this was the most important issue. Our land, what it means for the climate fight ahead. And it was a way for me to grapple with kind of the difficult parts of Roosevelt's legacy, but the important parts and the future of how we save land in the country.
So did that trip help you grapple with sort of where we are in regards to Roosevelt's legacy in saving lands?
It did. And I guess the most, you know, people often say, what surprised you? Well, what surprised me is the swerve the book took once I did meet with Regina Lopez Whiteskunk and realized that there was this native possibility that, you know, and it made me rethink, you know, how we treat this public land. Are we using it? Are we ripping into it? Are we fracking it? The idea of Bears Ears was it was going to be land that was used for ceremony, for traditional gathering of plants, and that it was going to be a more inclusive vision. So that was really exciting. But that also leads back to Roosevelt himself, whose attitude, as I said before, toward Native Americans was not enlightened in the slightest, who in fact believed in manifest destiny, a concept that was half a century old at that part. So I said in the book that if we're going to give him credit for being prescient about environmental issues, we have to criticize him where he's behind the times. You know, if we say he's ahead of the times in some things, we have to. So I think he's a great test case right now for the cancel culture and for our ability to not be simplistic when we look back, to say this guy's messy, he's hypocritical, he's not, you know, in any way perfect and not up to our standards in certain ways, but think of all he did. You know, as he said, it's not the critic who counts, right? It's the doer. And he was a doer, and what he did is save all that land. So I guess the lesson there for me is you're not going to please people. You're going to get attacked, particularly in the age of Twitter. But, you know, if you are committed to land and saving land, that can be a vision that drives you forward.
We're speaking with David Gessner, the author of Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. And David, we've been discussing about how for this book you went and visited those very lands that Theodore Roosevelt did and then later protected. But you also dug into Roosevelt's writings. In digging into his writings, and you mentioned he was a prolific writer, did that help you better understand it, or did it muddy that complicated figure that we've been discussing?
I'd say both, because, you know, what I really was attracted to was his kind of naturalist writing and his early writing, these hunting trips, books, series of books that are that he leaves from the Badlands out on these trips. And the writing is very, you know, it's funny. I mentioned, I think, in the book that another macho writer came around a generation later named Hemingway, who had a similar aesthetic in a way, where these beautiful descriptions and the light shafting down and, you know, the pine needles underfoot, and then there'd be hunting. So, you know, Roosevelt would erupt in spasms of slaughter in the midst of these beautiful lyric things. So that's what I mean by both. I was really impressed by the lyricism and the beauty of the writing about nature. And also, you know, then there'd have to be a kind of a swaggering hunting scene in there, which, you know, that's who he was. He's not being untrue to himself at all. And, of course, Roosevelt also had this kind of bizarro modern tendency. I say he was like a reality show onto himself. He'd be doing these things. Like, he was in the middle of a presidential tour. He'd go out into Yellowstone and study elk all day. So he had that aspect where he could get absorbed in the natural world. But he also was just a self-promotion machine. You know, he said, his daughter said of him, his daughter Alice, "My father always wanted to be the corpse at every funeral, the bride at every wedding, and the baby at every christening." So, you know, so he's a complex figure. And in that way, I think he's, you know, he challenges us now. What can we take and what do we reject? And that's kind of getting to the spirit of the book, which is, I'm not a biographer. You know, I'm not Edmund Morris. I'm more of a biographical adventurer. And what I come to biography for is what I can put to use in my life, you know, what I can take from it. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about biography is you can read it as a kind of highfalutin self-help book at times, you know. And one of the things I take from Roosevelt, he went out to the Badlands because his wife and mother died within the same 24-hour period when he was 24 years old. And he went out there and, you know, rather than collapse, he threw himself into activity. He exorcised his demons out there, and that energy never left him. I mean, there's a moment, and he's such a Renaissance character, too. There's a moment in the Badlands where boat thieves steal his boat and head down up the Little Missouri. And it's an ice storm, and the river's clogged with ice, and Roosevelt and his two ranch hands jump in the boat and chase after the boat thieves, who they eventually catch. But first he grabs Anna Karenina off the shelf, and he reads Tolstoy in the back of the book while they're chasing him down. And, you know, even when he was president, he'd go swim, you know, and hike, and he would read a book. Like, you know, at one point in his life, one a night he would devour books. So to me, that's really exciting. It's a little hyperkinetic. He also was a huge coffee drinker, which shouldn't surprise anybody if he's doing all that stuff. And he coined the phrase, good to the last drop, that Maxwell House then used for years.
Yeah, his reach, the reach was never ending, it seems. Well, I didn't.
Yeah, that excites me. You know, I mentioned Churchill earlier. I don't know why he's cropping up, but, you know, he was famous for, he loved the quotation, "A change is as good as a rest," you know. And that's certainly true in Roosevelt's life, too.
Well, I did want to ask you then what you took from the phrase that made it into the title of your book in 1903. President Theodore Roosevelt, while standing near the Grand Canyon, said, "Leave it as it is. You cannot improve on it. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it." So what did that say to you?
Well, I think it's, to me, first of all, that speech was kind of the Gettysburg Address of environmentalism, and it also included the phrase, "for our children's children," you know, kind of connecting us to trying to make people understand, to connect them by blood to the future. You know, it's this brilliant speech. And I think it still holds true. I mean, people say, well, it's more complicated, you know, it's not like that anymore. But there's still some validity to just saying, leave it as it is. And the enemy there is not necessarily just like the fossil fuel industry. It's human nature, right? None of us are very good at leaving it as it is, where we scratch the itch. In a way, you could say the crisis we're in right now, the pandemic, is the product of not leaving it as it is. You know, we didn't leave bats alone. You could apply it to so many things, and it's a discipline and work to leave something as it is, to not dig it up, frack it, rip it apart. And you have to fight back against human nature to do that. Just a funny aside is, at the last minute, they tried to change the title of my book. So the publishers thought it wasn't a good title. And so I wrote a long note, polite note, but I ended it with, leave it as it is. You know, like, so it's a handy phrase. You can use it for lots of things.
Yeah, that certainly came in handy. And I guess that thinking is a little bit, some might think it's counterintuitive to combating the effects of climate change to actually leave land as it is, right? It seems counterintuitive to for trying to stop something that actually to stay, take a step back and let it remain and land go to its natural flow and natural environment. And do you find that a little bit difficult to wrangle with?
A little bit. I mean, I was in the West and in the same area as Bears Ears and talking to an environmentalist there who suggested that ultimately large-scale zoning, you know, was part of what we needed to do. And that included, you know, there are scientists who are aiding migrating species who are migrating both north and upward with climate change. So there are places where we probably can't leave it as it is. There is still, you know, the recreation society, both the groovy recreation society, hikers, and the ATVers, they're going to use land. But I guess I'm not saying to leave all of it as it is, but to have places that we put aside and do nothing with and let, you know, evolution evolve and let nature do its thing. I mean, we've even seen a little taste of that during the pandemic, right? When we saw mountain lions prowling down the main street of Boulder in the snow, when we suddenly saw villages that could see the Himalayas again, right? Or waters becoming clear. I mean, it's miraculous what can happen when we do leave it as it is.
David Gessner is the author of Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. David, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure.